So today is about the midway point of the retreat. Starting to slide downhill now. Well, we've been building a momentum of our practice, mindfulness, and just to encourage people to continue to consolidate and allow that mindfulness and composure that's been gathering to establish itself. You know, inevitably there's always ups and downs, but I think if we and of course the feeling is always that somehow we're not quite getting it, not quite getting the mind as mindful and peaceful as we would like or what we think we should do. But that's the nature of desire. And I think to step back and kind of objectively to realize, sometimes even despite ourselves, we're getting peaceful. it's also a full moon today, which for our monastic life is we don't really have weekends, but the rhythm of our life is more around the lunar cycles, full moon, new moon, half moons. So today is a full moon. If we were at the monastery, we'd have a meditation vigil late into the night. I won't subject you to that. But one of the things we do as monastics on the full moon and new moon is to we have a recitation of our rules of training, our discipline. And it's a way of reviewing our conduct and establishing ourselves in things that we might have slipped up on or gotten caught up in. So it's a way of renewing on a fortnightly basis our own commitment to integrity and training. So it's a helpful reminder for all of us, because we all need to keep reestablishing our connection with the training, with the practice. Even if we're really diligent, it's just the nature of the mind to either to get inured or just get used to something or get caught in a particular habit or a comfortable rhythm, and just to step back and review and reflect in order to breathe life into our practice, our training. And so that sense of renewing and reconnecting with the practice. So even during a retreat, a 10-day retreat, we can similarly get into particular routines, or we've started out with a particular assumption of how we're going to practice, get it all lined up, and it's helpful to review. Okay, is it working? Is it helping? Is it beneficial? Or it's been maybe going through a particular difficulty, or it's been problematic, and so on. Oh, well, how do we renew and reconnect? How do we reestablish that connection? So that reviewing is important. Even the teachings that I've been giving, reviewing. And sometimes I don't really plan out what I'm going to say or what I'm going to teach. And people ask me, "Oh, you're going on a 10-day, what are you going to be teaching about?" Not quite sure. I actually did have a bit of a plan, I said, oh, I think. And I haven't got around to it yet. It's just never, it hasn't come up. It's other things have been coming up, so I just. But also, oftentimes, I think, okay, 10-day Thanksgiving retreat, what do I say? It's the same old stuff. But it's that, you know, it's actually the same old stuff that's really important. Reviewing, reconnecting with it. It's like the, with that, that last section of the last tetrad of the discourse on mindfulness and breathing, beginning with contemplating anicca, contemplating impermanence, uncertainty. I breathe in, contemplating impermanence, I breathe out. That's a fundamental truth that, you know, we all know. But we tend to skip over the surface of it. We tend not to bring it in and contemplate it or make it alive. So it didn't change us. We just recited the Buddha's first discourse this morning in English, and that insight that when the Buddha gave the discourse on the noble truths, it was Kundanya who realized it had an insight into stream entry. It's the spotless immaculate vision of the Dhamma. It's the and that's the Dhamma chakku, the eye of the Dhamma, insight into Dhamma, vision into the Dhamma. And as it's translated here, everything that has the nature to arise has the nature to cease. And you know, on a certain level, you know, even though we know that, why aren't we enlightened? You know? So it's not just an intellectual knowledge, but it's allowing that knowledge to really reverberate in our being and allow it to be the catalyst for clear seeing and relinquishment. But that contemplating that simple step, because there was four other practitioners who listened to that same teaching, and they didn't get it in the same way. It's just Kundanya who understood. And throughout the suttas, actually, that's the characteristic description of the that insight into the first level of awakening, into stream entry. In the scriptural language, yam kinchi samudhiya dhammang sambandhang niloda dhammang. And you know, whatever is of the nature to arise is of the nature to cease. It's also, quite literally translated as, whatever arising Dhamma, all ceasing Dhamma. So it's very literal. It's not very beautiful English. But it's also, you know, in terms of experience, to recognize that whatever we see as arising, coming into being, on a certain level, you know, it's already ceasing. It's the seeds of its cessation are there. I mean, we tend to forget that on both ends of the scale. Either we get excited about the arising, we get frustrated at the ceasing, And, what I had has ended. What I didn't have, now I have. And so we go up and down with that. And because that's a suffering. To be contemplating this nature of impermanence, innocent anicca, or inconstancy, or uncertainty. Is that, you know, just as we breathe in, it's kind of like the breath is arising, it's coming in. But on a certain level, it's already ceasing. The seeds of its cessation are there. So even on the very minor level of each in-breath, each out-breath, each thought or feeling that arises, to see this arising and ceasing together as a means of cutting through the habit of investing our attachment and desire, our preferences and our likes and our dislikes. It isn't that we don't have any likes or dislikes. It isn't as if the Buddha didn't have any preferences, but it's the investment in it, the attachment to it, the assumption of its correctness. Just because I've got this particular feeling, this preference, this like or this dislike, that's right, everything else is wrong. It's how it should be. And that's where we create suffering. That's where we create problems. So that too, there's discourses where the Buddha what comes to mind immediately is this one time where he's sitting in the monastery and it's actually Sariputta brings a whole group of new monks to the monastery. It's late. They've spent a long time trying to get there, and they get there late in the afternoon or early evening, and the Buddha's at his dwelling place, sitting meditation, the new monks are not so well trained, not so composed. They're making a lot of racket, a lot of noise, talking. They're excited to be at the Jeto Anna with this. And the Buddha's there, and the Buddha hears this racket and asks Ananda, "What's this racket? And it sounds like a bunch of fishermen at market day, isn't it?" And they say, "Oh, Sariputta's brought a whole bunch of new monks." And he said, "Tell them to get out of here. Tell them to leave. I mean, it's really improper, making all this noise." And they, the Buddha had a different preference, a definite preference for being, there are certain standards as a monastic, a certain quality of composure that is appropriate. And but then the next day he tracked down Sariputta and then talked with him and taught the new monks again, but it was a lesson. So definitely, the Buddha is not sort of, whatever. no feelings, no sense impressions, don't even touch consciousness. Just doesn't work like that. Even in fully enlightened being is experiencing the senses, but it's the problem is the investment in attachment and clinging and assumptions of solidity and permanency, constancy. So the reflection on impermanence is just so important. Also the contemplation of say, the next step in the mindfulness of breathing is contemplating dispassion. I breathe in, contemplating dispassion. I breathe out. So this quality of dispassion in the Pali is vitraka. Raka is like passion. And it's a strong word, passion, desire. And vitraka is sort of, it's a sort of dispassion. And so there's a discourse where the Buddha teaches a monk. He's very ill, or he instructs Ananda to go and teach this sick bhikkhu, Girimananda. And the Buddha gives these different contemplations and reflections. And one of the contemplations is contemplation of dispassion. And the way that the Buddha describes dispassion is something like, this is peaceful, this is sublime, the stilling of all formations, the abandoning of defilements, the realization of sort of coolness, nibbana, the ending of suffering. This is peaceful, this is sublime. So that inclining to what is peaceful and sublime rather than things that stir up the mind, entangle the mind. Quality of dispassion is an opportunity for cooling and settling. Another translation of that word viraka is fading away, allowing the excitement of things to fade away. Just that there's a real sort of ease that we can experience when we let that excitement and drive kind of fade away, that drive for gratification, the drive for being and becoming, it's really peaceful, delightful. And one of the things is also paying attention. Well, what is it that feeds that process of, say, a passion, of attachment, of clinging, of grasping? And that's an image that the Buddha uses in terms of feeding, of nutriment. What is it that nourishes our entanglement with the world, and that nourishes our relationship with suffering, because we keep feeding it. I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, there's a statement the Buddha makes, is that the one thing is that all beings subsist on nutriment. So that's it's a true statement on a mundane level. But it's also on a intellectual, emotional, spiritual, all these different levels. We subsist on nutriment. We rely on and we seek nourishment. And you have to pay attention to what we nourish ourselves with. I was actually just at breakfast this morning, I think we were sort of talking about the portions in America, sort of restaurants. Even if it's really good food, but if the portions are monstrous, we over-nourish. It's not healthy nourishment. And we don't really pay attention to what is actually a good balance, a good nourishment. He's actually a nutrition scientist or something, so PhD, and nutrition science and do all sorts of experiments. And one of the ones I really liked is when, I can't remember which one it is, it's somewhere in the East. And they have a nutrition science, they have a restaurant set up so that it's, and it's got a nice ambience, it's well set up, it looks like a proper restaurant, they can do it. So that, and experimenting with different things. And one of the experiments was the soup bowl was set up with a kind of a pipe underneath so that the soup kept coming in. And people were just talking away, eating. And it was just, they knocked back a lot of soup. So they're not really paying attention. Oh, there's the nutrition, but then it's just, wow, it tastes good. I'm just, keep going for it. And we do that with our senses. And that's one of the nutriments of, is physical food. And when the Buddha talks about it, these different kinds of nutriment, there's the window of understanding opens up on different areas of our experience, so that with physical food, when we can understand our relationship with physical food, then we can understand our relationship with the what the Buddha calls the five chords of sensual desire. So sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. So that we can understand how we relate to our senses. Because we're feeding on our contact with the senses. We're looking for that kind of nourishment, of excitement, of interest, or even something to get upset about. Yeah, that's a kind of nourishment. We can get very righteous, so that paying attention to our relationship with food. And of course, that's in the daily contemplation that the monastics do for contemplating before our meal. Yeah, this is for not for fun, not for pleasure, not for fattening, not for beautification, only for the maintenance and nourishment of the body, for keeping it healthy, for helping with a holy life, thinking, thus I will allay hunger without overeating. So continuing, I will live blamelessly and at ease. It's a reminder to establish a clear mindfulness around food and how we nourish ourselves. But it has a bigger implication than just food. We start to learn of how we relate to our other senses, because it's the same principle. The other nourishment is sense contact in Pali Passa, so the contact with the senses, just the desire, the motivation or need, have contact with the senses. And what the Buddha says we can learn, and what we need to learn from that is the feeling. There's a different types of feeling. Pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling. Because we're seeking some kind of stimulation, some kind of contact. And of course the feeling, contact, feeling, desire, attachment is a part of dependent origination. But that feeling piece is really important to understand, because it's fundamental to our relationship to the senses, the world, and internally, our own internal being. So, the Buddha says if we understand feeling, if we really understood feeling, we would be liberated, fully liberated. If we understood, that from the physical food and the sense, the five chords of sense desire, if we really understand that, well, there'd be, I said, the logical conclusion to that would be anagami, non-returner, really being able to penetrate that. But the understanding feeling opens up the possibility of full liberation. The other nutriment that the Buddha points to is mental volition. Mental volition, and yeah, the thinking processes, the formulating of our thought processes, because that feeds the whole process of being, becoming, the whole process of, say, setting in motion our karmic volition. And when we pay attention to that impulse, that volition toward thought and formulation of that kind of impression in the mind, we can understand the three forms of desire, which is, say, like we chanted this morning in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha points to three forms of desire as the fundamental root of suffering. Desire toward sensuality, desire for being, toward being, existence, and then the desire for non-being, annihilation. How do we get rid of? So that, and those are very basic processes in the mind, but we're nourished by them. We seek them out for food and sustenance. That's how we sustain ourselves. It's so hard just to be peaceful, isn't it? Where was it? Really delight. Oh, this is peaceful. This is sublime. Oh, the stilling of all formations. And, you know, the mind hardly leaps to it. Give me something to do. Give me something to become. Give me something to be in conflict with. Give me something to keep suffering over. So it's just understanding the processes, and this is, you know, especially as we get as we settle in meditation and practice, then in retreat, just looking at some of those fundamental movements of the mind, and then realize that it's actually just a slight shift of relationship. So that relationship of dispassion. Oh, I can. Oh, you can see something, and you don't have to get all tied up in knots about it. It's just this way. It's like this. That's Ajahn Sumedho's refrain in his teaching over years. Oh, it's like this, and it's just all right. Yeah, desire and attachment. It's like this. Okay. Dispassion. Yeah, it's just a simple shift, so that opening up the possibility of that quality of dispassion, and the heart really, this is where the heart really comes alive. Oh, this is peaceful. This is sublime. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, the heart delights in that. And the last nutriment that the Buddha points to is consciousness itself, just to have that conscious existence of consciousness as a distinct being. But then what we can understand is that name and form, whatever we're identify with, is just name and form. Mentality, materiality, causal processes that rely on each other to keep being fed, keep being nourished, keep plugging along in samsara. All of these are reflections that give us an opportunity to not get entangled in the process of sense of self, a sense of me, of mine. Because that's the glue that holds it all together. And say, oh, this is I am, this is me. They're talking about me. And you know, this takes up a lot of space. This is mine. There's a lovely story in the from the Desert Fathers, early days of Christianity, and as they're religious seekers living out in the desert, and there were these two elders who were shared a cell together, and they'd never quarreled with each other, never, and they'd been living out and living their religious life for years, and they'd never quarreled. And one of them said to the other, "Come on, we've been here for years, and we've never quarreled. We've never had a disagreement. We should have some sort of disagreement so we can. It's what ordinary people do. It's just be like the others." And the other monks are just saying, "How do they do that?" the other one who'd he's obviously been studying and learning. He said, "Well, I've noticed what they do. Same thing. You know, they take something and then they, you know, say that this is mine," and then they get into disagreement about that. So I said, "So what we could do is just take this, we can take this brick and say, and then I'll say this is mine, and then and then you you have to then say, well, this is mine." Okay, so. And so he said, "Okay," so they put this brick in his hand. "Okay, this is mine." And the other ones are saying, "Well, sir, you know, I do think it's mine." And then the other one said, "Well, I don't think, no, really, this is mine." And then the other one said, "Well, if it's yours, go ahead and take it." So they never were able to get into an argument. this nutriment is feeding the whole process. This is mine. So the heart of contact, and to actually turn to this dispassion of, "Oh, this is way not mine." "This is peaceful. This is sublime." Okay, so we can contemplate and reflect on these.